everybody is looking at, you know, contactless, humanless, because in the robot itself, it has its own disinfection, UVC light.
Syria calls on the United Nations to condemn Israel's repeated acts of aggression against its sovereignty. China's Lamzas Radio for scrapping a landmark cooperation agreement, saying that a move risks further damage to bilateral ties. Germany is in talks with Russia to buy 300 million doses of the Sputnik V vaccines once it's approved by the European Medical Authority. This is World News. I'm Bahar Zajafi. Good to have you with us. Starting with Syria, the country is condemning the latest Israeli missile attacks on its territory, describing them as a clear violation of the 1974 agreement on disengagement. The foreign minister urged the UN to condemn the move and the repeated violations of Syrian sovereignty. It urged UN General Secretariat and Security Council to assume responsibility under the UN Charter in maintaining international peace and security. Now, that reaction came after the Israeli regime carried out missile strikes near the Syrian capital, Damascus. Tel Aviv has repeatedly performed strikes against Syria over the past years. We're joined by our Damascus correspondent, Mohammed Ali, who provided us with some details on Syria's reaction to the Israeli attacks on its soil.
The Syrian Foreign Ministry statement confirms that Syria will not allow those attackers, meaning Israel in particular, and the terrorists to achieve their goals in destroying Syria, and that all of those attempts and attacks on Syria will not block or prevent the Syrian army from carrying out its mission in defeating terrorism on Syria. In previous statements, always the Syrian government makes it clear that the aim of such attacks on Syria is to undermine the capabilities of the Syrian army, weaken the army so that the army would not actually achieve a final victory on terrorism all across Syrian territories. This is definitely not the first attack by Israel on Syria, and despite all of the letters sent to the United Nations, still no measures is being taken by the international body to put an end to such attacks by Israel.
Now, Israel's Minister of Military Affairs has admitted that the regime's missile systems failed to intercept an anti-aircraft missile that Tel Aviv says was fired from Syria. Benny Gantz said an investigation has been launched into the failure of the so-called Iron Dome to intercept the projectile. Tel Aviv saying that a Syrian surface-to-air missile exploded near its Dimona nuclear plant early Thursday. In response, Israeli forces performed air raids in the Syrian territory. U.S. media reports said that the incident points to possible Iranian involvement. There have been no claim of responsibility or comment from Tehran. Also, Israeli media say that the following sabotage attempt at Iran's Natanz facility, Israel's anti-missile systems around the Dimona plant have been on high alert in anticipation of an attack. Tehran and Washington remain in a standoff as both sides are calling on the other to take the first step to return to its deal-related commitments. Now, Iran has made it clear what the U.S. needs to do in order to go back to compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal and revive it. That is the removal of all anti-Iran sanctions at a go. However, Washington has refrained from doing so. The U.S. is unwilling to remove all the sanctions, seeking instead to classify them into removable, non-removable, and negotiable ones.
Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are holding talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna, trying to salvage the accord. The 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, has been at crisis ever since the United States left the pact unilaterally in 2018 and imposed sanctions against Iran. While Tehran's precondition for returning to compliance is removal of all U.S. sanctions, Washington has so far refrained from doing so. U.S. media have cited a source close to America's top nuclear negotiator, Robert Malley, in Vienna, as saying that Washington is opposed to removal of all sanctions imposed on Iran. Current U.S. officials and sources close to American and European negotiators have now been saying that the U.S. is dividing the post-JCPOA sanctions into JCPOA-related and non-JCPOA-related ones, and intends to remove only the former. The presence of numerous Iranian names on the United States specially designated nationals and blocked persons list, even if apparently unimportant individuals, would also sharply restrict the ceiling for Iran's benefits from the JCPOA. Iran wants these names to also be removed. Iran, meanwhile, is saying that it considers all those sanctions as JCPOA-related because they were imposed with the intent to affect the deal and its implementation, or most recently, the negotiations to revive it. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, says Tehran is proposing a logical path to the U.S. for its full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. He called on the U.S. to return to full compliance first, and then Iran will reciprocate after rapid verification of Washington's compliance. Zarif also stressed that all sanctions imposed by former President Donald Trump must be removed. The main sanctions were imposed on Iran's oil and banking sectors. Speaking to Press TV, Iran's top negotiator and deputy foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, highlighted Tehran's stance on returning to compliance with the pact.
We only go back to full compliance when the U.S. has lifted all sanctions imposed or reimposed or relabeled after January 2017 and has verified by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Then we would go for full compliance.
The Iranian diplomat also rejected the idea of a step-by-step return to the nuclear accord.
Well, certainly there are sanctions that were imposed under the Trump administration separate from the JCPOA that were designed to make it more difficult for the Biden administration to get back into the deal. But the Biden administration had time before it came into the White House, and now it's been 3 months. They have had the time to figure out how to lift those sanctions that were not related to the JCPOA.
Now, according to sources close to European and U.S. negotiators, Washington is willing to only remove sanctions outlined in the nuclear deal. They say that, however, sanctions that aren't consistent with the JCPOA will remain in place. Now, that would mean that the U.S. is seeking to divide the anti-Iran sanction into removable, irremovable, and negotiable ones. That could strike a heavy blow to the talks in Vienna to revive the deal, as far as removal of all sanctions is the only way to salvage negotiations from collapse.
During the former U.S. administration of Donald Trump, Washington unilaterally left the JCPOA. Trump reimposed a series of expansive sanctions on Iran that had been lifted under the deal, this time not under the pretext of concerns about Iran's nuclear program, which the JCPOA had already addressed, but under new labels, for instance, so-called sponsorship for terrorism. However, Robert Malley, the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, has already admitted that the maximum pressure campaign launched by the previous administration yielded no results. He said Washington is seeking to achieve a mutual return to compliance with the nuclear deal. While the U.S. seems to try to use the sanctions as leverage in the negotiations on the 2015 nuclear deal, Iran has made it clear that it will only return to its commitments under the accord once it has verified that all imposed, reimposed, and relabeled U.S. sanctions against Tehran are removed.
Certainly, if there are remaining sanctions that are having an impact on the Iranian bank, for example, that makes it hard to have transactions with not only the U.S., but countries all over the world, that is problematic. If there continue to be sanctions that make other companies in countries outside the U.S. Worried about doing business with Iran because they continue to be afraid that they will be sanctioned by the United States. That is problematic. And so the U.S. really has to lift all of these sanctions because they are interconnected.
Iran is articulating what should happen in order for the deal to be revived in its original form. By refusing to listen, the United States and Europe are only making it more difficult for the prospect to materialize.
Now, in other news, China is slamming Australia for scrapping a landmark cooperation agreement. It says that Canberra has moved risks further damage to bilateral relations.
The Australian federal government has no reason to cancel the Belt and Road Cooperation Agreement between the Victoria State government and the Chinese government. This brings reckless interference and damage to our regular exchanges and cooperation. This severely harms China-Australian relations and mutual trust. This will make an already strained relationship between China and Australia even worse.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman says this country has lodged solemn representations with Australia. He urged Canberra to abandon what it calls a Cold War mindset and reverse the decision. Meantime, the Australian Prime Minister has defended his country's decision to revoke the Victoria State government's deal to join China's Belt and Road Initiative. Scott Morrison says the federal government's actions are in the national interests of Australians.
And the Foreign Relations Act that our government put in place was designed to protect our national interests by ensuring that there were no other agreements entered into by any other level of government that would conflict with Australia's national interest. And so what we've done is we've followed through. And there have been four agreements that the Foreign Minister has terminated in line with that Foreign Relations Act, that power that we were able to attract from the Parliament.
On Wednesday, Australia announced the revocation of the flagship cooperation agreements between Victoria State and Beijing, saying that the accords were inconsistent with its foreign policy. Relations between the two sides have soured since Canberra called for an independent probe into the origins of the COVID-19 last year. Beijing has since slapped Canberra with a range of trade reprisals, including heavy tariffs and also blocking coal shipments. China is also angry at Australia for banning Chinese telecom giant Huawei from the country's 5G infrastructure. The Czech Republic is asking Russia to reduce the number of its diplomats at the Prague embassy to match the number of the Czech embassy staff in Moscow. Now, Prague said that Moscow will have until the end of May to comply with the request. The Russian Foreign Ministry said it would quickly respond to the latest move, lamenting that Prague is on the path to destroy bilateral relations. Now, that follows a rift earlier this week that saw dozens of diplomats expelled from both sides. Tensions hiked after Prague expelled 18 Russian embassy staff over the alleged involvement of Russian intelligence in the 2014 explosion. Russia retaliated by ordering out 20 Czech diplomats. Meantime, NATO has backed the Czech Republic, saying it stands in full solidarity with Prague.
Allies expressed deep concern over the destabilizing actions Russia continues to carry out across the Euro-Atlantic area, including on alliance territory, and stand in full solidarity with the Czech Republic.
The European Union has also expressed support for Prague and the deepening row. The dispute is the sharpest between the two countries since the end of the communist era in late 1980s. Prague had called on the EU and NATO countries to expel Russian diplomats in a coordinated show of support. The two have so far shied away from taking further measures against Moscow, and this at a time of acute tensions in Russian relations with the West over a host of issues, including jailing of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny and a conflict in Ukraine. Now, Germany is negotiating with Russia on purchasing 30 million doses of the Sputnik V coronavirus vaccine. The premier of Saxony State made the announcement after meeting with the Russian health minister in Moscow. Michael Kretschmer stressed that the purchases will take place only if the European drugs regulator approves the shot. A In early April, Germany's decision to buy the Sputnik vaccine without waiting for coordinated EU action sparked controversy. So far, the bloc has rolled out jabs from Moderna, Oxford AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, and Pfizer. Of course, they've been facing lots of troubles with that. Now, the coronavirus pandemic is adding to the woes of Gaza's Strip's ailing economy, which has been battered by the Israeli blockade since 2007. Poverty and unemployment rates have also risen amid the, in the midst of all these problems in that tiny enclave. Ashraf Shannon has more.
The coronavirus pandemic continues to add extra strains on Gaza Strip's ailing economy. All economic sectors in the impoverished seaside sliver are already suffering because of the Israeli blockade and multiple wars. Precautionary measures, including lockdowns to prevent the spread of the deadly virus, have weakened the commercial movement and the purchasing power. According to the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics, unemployment and poverty are further increasing in the enclave because of the pandemic.
The coronavirus pandemic has paralyzed the economy in Gaza, and many businesses are no longer making any money. The manufacturing as well as the service and hotel sectors were hit the hardest by the pandemic. The agricultural sector has also suffered huge losses.
The pandemic has threatened the socioeconomic welfare of nearly 2 million Palestinians living in the blockaded enclave. Most Gazans are currently finding it hard to provide for their families, and around 80% of them rely on some form of aid to survive.
The coronavirus pandemic is destroying our economy, and things are getting worse day in and day out. Everyone has been affected, whether the laborers, factory workers, or taxi drivers.
We are going through the worst economic conditions. People have lost their sources of income, and poor families are getting poorer. If we don't work on a daily basis, we will not be able to feed our families.
Economic repercussions of the coronavirus pandemic in the Gaza Strip, as in the rest of the world, have been grave. The income of day laborers in Gaza has fallen by almost 90% since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, and tens of thousands have lost their jobs.
Thousands of people depend on daily labor to earn a living, and they continue to suffer. The economy is going through the worst time, and poverty has witnessed a sharp increase. An international intervention is required to remedy the situation.
According to UN figures, the Israeli regime is responsible for the near collapse of Gaza's economy.
Experts say the coronavirus pandemic has only compounded the dire economic problems in Gaza. About 2 million Palestinians have been under an Israeli blockade there since 2007. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
IRIB English Radio presents The Month of Allah. Let's be with Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Abbas Razavian.
As I look to nature's beauty, dazzled am I, knowing everything comes on you, the Lord Most High.
Allah, Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalam ala ashrafil anbiya'i wal mursaleen, Sayyidina Abul Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. Welcome to the program Month of Allah. Today we want to talk about the different stages in fasting, and that each and every one of us, we have to strive this month of Ramadan to increase the level and intensity of the fast that we have. What do I mean by this intensity? See, brothers and sisters, there are different stages that we can understand from our traditions about fasting. The first stage that we have, we read in Dua 44 of As-Sahifa As-Sajjadiyya. وَعِنَّا عَلَى صِيَامِهِ بِكَفْ الْجَوَارِهِ أَنْ مَعَاسِيكِ. And help us to fast in it by restraining our limbs from acts of disobedience towards you. Ya Allah, help us, help our limbs, help our body parts to be able to fast and not to commit any of the invalidators of fast. See, brothers and sisters, this is the first stage of fasting. We have in the books of Islamic law maybe about 9 different Islamic laws, invalidators of fast. The first stage is to learn, research, and study, and to make sure we don't perform any of these 9 invalidators, like eating, drinking, sexual activity, say, immersing our head under the water, according to some of the fuqaha, or, for example, vomiting intentionally, swallowing thick dust, attributing lies to the Prophet, and other invalidators. This is the first step. So in this first step, there's going to be learning. Many of us are young. We want to start fasting for the first time. Open the Islamic law book and look at invalidators and see what will make our fast valid and what make our fast invalid. The second thing is staying away from sin. In this sermon that the Holy Prophet of Islam gave before the month of Ramadan, we see that a question is asked by Imam Ali alayhi salam. He says, "Ma afdalu al-a'mal?" He asks him, "Qultu ya Rasulullah, ma afdalu al-a'mal?" What is the best action in the month of Ramadan? It is a very important question. We want to know. We want to make sure we do the best action in this month. And the answer is, Ya Aba al-Hasan, أفضل الأعمال في هذا الشهر الورع عن محارم الله عز وجل. The best action in the month of Ramadan is staying away from sin. It is very simple, but sometimes difficult for us. Therefore, stage 2 is that if we, God forbid, commit different sins, violate the rules of Allah. For example, we might listen to music. We should put away that haram music. And when we fast, we should make sure that we only listen to what is halal. We're protecting our ears from haram. Sometimes we have to protect our eyes from haram and what we look at. About our tongue, what we say during this month while we're fasting is very important. So this is one of the best actions that we attain a level of taqwa. To explain how important this level is, look at one of the traditions in Makarim and Akhlaq that the Prophet of Islam tells Abu Dharr. What does he tell Abu Dharr? He tells him this, that Man ata Allah azza wa jal faqad dhakara Allah. Whoever obeys God has truly remembered God. وَإِنْ قَلَّتْ صَلَاتُهُ وَسِيَامُهُ وَتَلَاوَتُهُ لِلْقُرْآنِ. Even if he doesn't recite the Qur'an enough, even if he doesn't fast that much, say mustahab fasting, even if he doesn't pray that much, but he has remembered Allah because he has obeyed him. It is like that person that as we are a relationship between us and Allah. Our relationship between us and Allah is like a servant that faces his Lord. And the Lord gives him instructions. Imagine, the Lord gives his servant instructions and he reads it. And instead of following those instructions, the servant goes and does other things that he thought was maybe more important. He does other things that were more easy for him to do. So that Lord would be telling the servant, why didn't you perform those actions that I wanted? I wanted these actions. Therefore, we have to focus first on the wajibat, those obligatory actions, and staying away from the muharramat, the haram actions, the actions that are sins. The third stage of fasting is, as we see in Sahih al-Sajjadiyyah, that we increase our focus on staying away from lahu and lahu, staying away from idle talk, staying away from diversion, staying away from doing things that don't have any benefit for us. This is the third stage. And in the fourth stage is, this is for the more advanced stage, that is everything we do it for God. وَلَا نَتَكَلَّفَ إِلَّا مَا يُدْنِي مِنْ ثَوَابِكْ in Sahih al-Sajjadiyyah. So, and we don't undertake anything unless it has your reward. Everything we do, our breath that we take, even we breathe, we wake up, we sleep, all of it is for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And that is the fourth stage. So fasting has these different stages. One is to stop ourselves from committing the invalidators. Second is to stop sinning, understanding what is sin, and to stop sinning and fulfill our obligations. The third is to decrease our idle talk, decrease our lahu and diversion. And the fourth is that all our actions and everything we do, either if it's resting or not, it is all done in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa ahli bayti tayyibin tahirin.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام: الصيام والحج تسكين القلوب.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam said, the fast and the obligatory pilgrimage, Hajj, pacify the heart.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, ma lana rabbun siwa.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha
illallah, la ilaha illallah, ma lana rabbun siwa. Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Saving Capitalism, directed by Jacob Cornbluth. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Clive Menzies, who is involved in Critical Thinking, a research and educational project which seeks to understand how the political economy works and identify levers for change. Now, Saving Capitalism is a documentary that explores the reasons why the economic system that once made the US strong is suddenly failing. The film is a clear-eyed examination of a political and economic status quo that no longer serves the people, exposing the powerful alliances between Washington and Wall Street, as well as the extreme wealth disparity in the US. And starring Robert Reich, and whose book inspired the film, served as Labor Secretary under President Bill Clinton, takes us through the US's fragile democracy and its fight for survival, and argues that it's up to ordinary US citizens to change the rules.
The
there's a huge amount of anger and frustration. So many people desperately wanting to be heard. And nobody is listening. It's up to us to change the rules. We are a two-tiered society composed of a few winners and a larger group of Americans left behind. And it's getting worse and worse and worse.
Thank you very much. Robert Rice, former labor secretary under President Clinton.
I want to go to places where I could actually interact. I really want to talk to people about their lives. Yes, that's true. As income and wealth go to the top, so does political power. People don't trust that our society is working for most people. Got to pay my bills, got to pay my rent. I'm hungry outside, but my money's all spent. Nobody in our society, the richest nation in the history of the world, should be working and not making it. The old assumption has been the division is Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah, something's way off all over the country. Right, left, everybody. Something's wrong.
This is about power. It's about reclaiming our democracy and reclaiming our economy.
This country is upside down, and it's not working for 99% of our society anymore.
We are at a critical turning point in this country, and this is dangerous. The only way forward is to get organized and politically active.
New York now! New York now!
Democracy is a very fragile thing.
It's now up to the next generation.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So I found this film an enlightening watch, and I think it offers an effective crash course on U.S. inequality, particularly on the economy. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Saving Capitalism?
It's a really easy film to watch. It's made in a kind of gentle, smoothly edited, it carries you along, it's intriguing, it's gripping. And Robert Reich is a really great central character. He's kind of warm and a little bit scruffy and impish and funny.
Very entertaining to watch.
He's very entertaining, and the things he says are incredibly pointed and they grab your attention. The central topic of the film is really strong. I don't know, I mean, the title is a little bit, I think, misleading almost, because I think it will put off a lot of viewers. But the central idea of the fact that, the economic system in America is tilted so heavily toward corporations is a really important message that I think needs to get out there. And so you're watching it, you feel your blood starting to boil. It's one of those documentaries that starts making you more and more angry, even as it kind of gives you some ideas of the way forward or what's likely to happen.
And Clive, if I could turn to you, as a political economist, what's your take on Saving Capitalism?
My first reaction was that it was something of a political pitch. And it was very articulate, very well done. It articulated the symptoms extremely well. Whether Reich's prescription for the remedy is appropriate, I would question, because it's the pendulum swinging back and forth. And Reich emerged in the 60s and 70s, and he seems to hark back to that as some sort of golden era, but that was just a temporary blip post-war in this long war of attrition, which is effectively what they managed in the 60s and 70s, both in the UK and in the US, was some sort of social contract, which was a renegotiation of the terms of slavery. But slavery certainly wasn't abolished, and I'm not sure that the thrust of this film gets us any closer to abolishing slavery, which is effectively what this system is.
Well, I suppose this documentary could only cover so much ground in 90 minutes or so, but I'm just wondering, as someone who's not familiar with the economy, does this serve as a good introduction to get to grips with what capitalism is and the arguments that Reich makes?
Yeah, and I thought it was quite interesting. I was making notes as the film unfolded, and I was writing down names that I thought ought to have been mentioned, and sure enough, they come in. He mentions Robert Rubin as Treasury Secretary, and you look at the sort of Clinton administration dynamic, and to some extent, Reich was in there as the pigeon, and he fought very hard, and he said, my only regret was I didn't push harder. The irony is he probably doesn't recognize that he couldn't have pushed harder or he would have been out, or he wouldn't have got anywhere anyway. So I think it's, for all his 5 decades of experience, I'm not sure he's learnt the game sufficiently. He didn't realise the pool, the shark-infested pool in which he was operating.
Now, we see his character sort of, and his character progression throughout the documentary, actually, and how sort of down-spirited he becomes, but also hopeful as well. But Rich, just wanted to ask you, for viewers not well-versed with the economy, do you think this film serves as a good introduction then?
Well, it's very interesting. It's obviously from a particular point of view, but what it does explain in the way that I haven't heard explained quite so simply and straightforwardly is how the whole economy was founded on a principle that was flawed, mm-hmm. basically tilted toward the wealthy and corporations right from day one, mm-hmm. and how people with power just consolidate their power. So it's only gotten worse over the last 250 years, and it's just, you know, now the general average person in America has no power really politically, which is quite a shocking thing to say, but when you think about it, it's true. And you look at the way laws are being passed and the way the government is behaving, mm-hmm. That's kind of how it's working. And but you see little, you know, people taking bites out of it. So I think the system has room to correct itself, and that helps. While you're watching the film, it helps you not be completely hopeless.
There's strong arguments to be made in this film, and of course aided by great animation sequences, yeah. and graphics as well.
Yeah.
Intuition right now is clear. Something's wrong. All over the country, right, left, everybody. Something's way off.
The old assumption has been the division is Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah, that's
but great. What we're beginning to see, yep. is that it's actually anti-establishment,
yeah.
versus establishment.
Yep.
It's people who don't want the big money and the crony capitalism versus the crony capitalists.
Yeah.
You know, Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, liberals, there's going to be disagreement on a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But if you could come together on these, yeah. fundamentals.
It's fine with me. You're at a deeper level, right? You've been teaching economics and all that for 30 years. I used to use your book.
You, yeah. used to use my book?
I used to use it.
Can
book
we just make, can you?
And
can
I have a book out, too.
Can
I'll
we get that again?
Mine.
Congressman, what do you think of the title?
Yeah, I know. It surprised me a little bit coming for you, but in a pleasant way. I think you and I are united on if we can do this in the right way, ethics and capitalism together, and we'll save the country.
I think what's interesting about this documentary is that Reich manages to put Republicans, both them and Democrats, around tables and get them to agree with him, actually, on this issue. And do you think Reich has all that political authority to do that?
Well, I mean, he is Democrat, and he's very kind of entrenched in that world. But I like the fact that he's looking beyond that. He's looking at the point that this is about an establishment, anti-establishment thing. He talks about Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump being anti-establishment. They're opposite ends of the political spectrum. But basically what they were proclaiming or what they were trying to do was the same thing, just overthrow the system. And,
but
and
of
that's
course
quite interesting. It's quite interesting that he's brought them both into the story.
Indeed, and I think at the time, we see Trump there. It was the early elections when they were, yeah. filming this documentary, and it was the front runners were Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton. But I don't think they could have foreseen that Trump would have won.
Well, no, nobody foresaw that, did they?
No, not at all. But I think the argument made in the film, though, is perhaps this anti-establishment sort of notion is that Trump was bringing corporate power to influence political power, which, of course, this documentary highlights. Would you agree with that, Clive?
Undoubtedly, and we've seen what's happened since. Trump has populated his administration with Goldman Sachs alumni and the usual suspects. So the system is so, corporate influence is so embedded in the system. I mean, Reich talks about lobbying, but lobbying is just the sort of the visible tip of the iceberg. It's basically embedded in the whole superstructure.
Well, the tax law that they passed was just purely aimed at helping corporations.
Exactly. So you know, the civil, what we call the civil servants in this country, the administrative engine is fully embedded with corporate interests, and the idea that changing the figurehead from red to blue or Democrat to Republican or vice versa is going to change anything. We saw it with Obama. We've seen it with Trump. You know, and you know, should this be a platform for another Bernie Sanders, it'll be exactly the same story. One has to question the system rather than the political flavor. And I think, frankly, I found that conversation with the Republican senator somewhat naive, really.
Oh, so Rich, what do you think about actually the arguments made in this documentary about the relationship between political power and the economy and corporate interests? Does it make strong arguments bringing the two together?
Well, it does. I mean, it makes very strong arguments that the people who have the money have the power. It's kind of obvious. But it's quite creepy to watch a film like this where they explain how that plays out, you know, through the lobbying, through the passage of laws, through financial contributions to campaigns, and then getting, you know, favors on the back end of that. And you realize that the system is just, it's just kind of eating itself, and it's very much a, it's perpetuating that corporate power and that kind of inequality, to where the, you know, the middle class is just shrinking and shrinking and shrinking.
So perhaps not surprising, but very
telling. It's not surprising, but it kind of helps. It helps you understand what's happening, because everybody knows this is happening, but nobody really gets why or how, or, you know, how it's affecting them. And this kind of helps. It helps you understand it a little bit better, and perhaps helps you, gives you a voice. I mean, that's what this kind of a film does. It might get people to stand up and say, "Wait a minute." Something has
it's
to happen.
It's an empowering documentary.
Yeah.
And there's
a moment in the film where they mention that this happened 100 years ago, which is really interesting. The exact same thing. And there was a huge backlash. The public came out protest. They elected all new people. They passed all these laws, which have pretty much all been overturned now. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. It's interesting that, you know, we're kind of repeating history. Mm-hmm. So.
I would like to touch on that actually a bit more in the next section.
I've been working at McDonald's for 4 years. I work at the drive-thru window. I get paid $12.55 per hour. I make about $1,200 a month. $900 goes straight to rent, and I have to pay for gas. And then my phone bill, I end up with nothing. I sometimes have to go to the payday loan and get a loan on my paycheck in order to make it on time and don't get any late fees and try to make ends meet.
Nobody should be working full time and not making it. Nobody in our society, the richest country, the richest nation in the history of the world, should feel as frightened and anxious and as insecure as so many people do today.
And Rich, what did you make of these sort of contributions to the documentary, these stories of McDonald's worker and also sort of farmer in the documentary also?
I think it's just an example of the thing that a lot of people are feeling, and it's regardless of what your political views are, that feeling like, why is life getting worse? Why is my paycheck not going as far as it went 5 years ago? Why do I feel like I'm earning less money and everything costs a lot more? There's something wrong here. When the wealthy people are just getting richer and richer and richer and richer, and they're buying cars and houses and they're living, and they're talking about how booming the economy is, and I'm not feeling that. And those stories reflect that, reflect something that almost all of us feel, unless we're in that top 1%, I think.
And Clive, I want to ask that question that Robert Wright raises. Why is it that people who are working full-time are struggling to make ends meet in one of the richest countries in the world?
There's an inevitability in where we've got to. I referred earlier that the post-war consensus did actually give people some semblance of a decent life. They were working hard, but they were being well rewarded. They didn't have to have multiple jobs. But I think that respite was only temporary, and there's a much deeper underlying problem than what the documentary brings out. But what the documentary, the power of the documentary is that it begins people on a journey of understanding. It may not go the whole way, but it certainly introduces concepts that may be totally alien to them, and having these stories actually puts them into the context of their own lives. But there is an inevitability to this idea that things get worse and worse, because essentially the wealth is sucked to the top, and there are very simple mechanisms that drive that. And it's to do with theft of what should belong to everyone, land, resources, etc., and usury, because it's just a straight interest on money. It's just a straight wealth transfer mechanism.
She said she had to take payday loans.
Exactly.
And of course,
so that
never
just exacerbates
debt.
It. Mm. So So this process, in days gone by, we had debt jubilees. And basically everything would be forgiven, we'd start afresh, and the system would reset. 1929 was a reset, and that's why all those laws were so effective, because it reset the economy. We had a crash in 87, we had a crash in 98, we had a crash in 2000, we had one in 2008. We've not had a reset. All that's happened is that the Fed has continued to pile more money into the system, which has done nothing to alleviate the hardship of people like that lady at McDonald's, but it's gone into asset price. It's driving more of the wealth to the top. So the system needs a reset, and the fear is that the reset will be much too painful. It'll be like the 1930s depression. And if we want to avoid that, we have to think in a different way. That doesn't come out of the film, but if this starts people on a journey of understanding...
At least it's a good starting point, yes.
Yeah, I think it does a very good job of opening the door to concepts that people probably don't think about, although they feel them, as Rich says, on a daily basis in their own lives.
And Rich, before we move on, I just quickly wanted to touch on the point you made about Wright earlier on, about him. You can tell, you get a sense from the documentary, he's trying really hard, he's been a senior political figure in America, but it doesn't seem like he's getting anywhere, and you can see his spirits sort of go down throughout the years.
It's just watching the system get worse and worse. And he talks about seeing the seeds of what we're seeing now, seeing it back in the 80s, you know, and realizing that this was going to happen. It was just going to get worse and worse. And
you can feel that sense of frustration from him.
Yeah, you do see him getting frustrated, and you saw him like in the clips from when he was working with Clinton, and he's trying to change things. And of course, he can't, because every bill he proposes is heavily compromised by exceptions and things, and which just basically made the situation even worse. Mm-hmm. So you do watch him kind of getting more and more demoralized, and then this film is basically his journey around the country to try to make sense of that and work a way forward. It is like you say, it's an opening of the door to the theme. It doesn't really get that deep into it. But it helps you understand in a way that you kind of makes you think, and you think, oh, maybe I do need to pay attention to the candidates more when the next election comes around, and pay attention to what they're saying.
Even in the insurance provider that I have, I was informed that they no longer cover chemo drugs fully. And so we were told by a medical social worker that we could potentially receive a bill for thousands of dollars. With the four drugs that I take for chemotherapy, the total comes out to about $3,000 a month per treatment. So for me, that's about 3 months of income just for one round of treatment.
What is the alternative to receiving your chemotherapy drugs? There isn't one. So whatever the cost is, you have to pay it.
You and I and everybody else in this country pays more for pharmaceuticals than any citizens of any advanced nation.
So you would think medicine should save people, not bankrupt them. Rich, what impression did you get of the pharmaceutical industry from this documentary?
Personally, you know, I live in the UK, and our government right now is trying to create that system here, which is terrifying to me. That's terrifying.
Increasing privatization.
Yeah, and making it so that we have to pay for everything, even though we already pay for it. Mm-hmm. I find that really disturbing. But, this clip is part of a bigger point in the film, because he talks about how Americans pay more for airfares, they pay more for, you know, virtually everything, internet access, mobile phones. Everything is more expensive because of these special interests that have created laws that basically give them bigger profits. And that these companies are regulated outside of America because they're considered public utilities and they're not allowed to have obscene profits. Mm-hmm. Because they're utilities. They're something everybody has to have. Mm-hmm. And
of course, essential.
And it's a bigger point in the film, is that these essential services shouldn't be allowed to make, you know, obscene profits
and
put people, you know, make people poor, basically.
Would you agree with what Rich said? Your thoughts on the sort of free-for-all economy?
On the pharmaceutical industry specifically, I think there's a deep misunderstanding of how we got here. Rockefeller was, one of the original Rockefellers was a snake oil salesman. And he basically, through endowing universities, medical schools, and health facilities, basically alienated the whole idea of natural medicine. That lady said there's no alternative. There are alternatives, actually effective alternatives. And the pharmaceutical industry is not about curing people, it's about making money. And if people get better, that's a side benefit. It's certainly not the main thrust. So the cost is part of this, but it's actually the industry itself is perpetuating illness because it's profitable. And if you look at the insured model, and Rich mentioned what's happening in this country, you go back pre the start of this privatization regime, management costs in the UK were about 4%. In America, they're 20% with this insured model. We're now at the last, there was a secret study done. It's not been published. It's been available through leaks in various places. I think we're up to about 14%. But where we're heading to is 20% of the cost going into management. In other words, going back up to
that is
the
very
top.
Worrying indeed. And just as we end in near the end of the show, I'd just like to discuss one of the key messages of this documentary, which is the power of ordinary citizens, I suppose, to rise up and to challenge the 1%. Clive, do you think, I'm sorry, Rich, do you think that this documentary ends on a hopeful note?
I mean, so many of these documentaries that make you angry end up by saying, you know, vote, use your vote, get out and protest. And, you know, that message has been going on for, we're 10 years into this economic system, this new world that we're living in, and it's not getting any better. It's getting worse. So,
just your final thoughts on the film now.
Yeah, so I think the film helps raise issues that need to be raised, and we need to watch these kinds of films so that we understand what's going on, and maybe that will help us use our vote more wisely and get out and protest where it's effective. But it does kind of make you feel a little hopeless.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to end it on a sad note there, but I wish we could talk more, but we've run out of time. Thank you very much. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you again to both my guests and to you.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.